James chapter 3, the last couple of times that we met together in our studies in the book of James, we have been dealing with his focus on the problem of the tongue as a metaphor of the external element of man without addressing the thing that it refers to. I mean, he blames it all on the tongue, but the tongue is just a muffle and can't be held really accountable. The problem, of course, is much deeper than that. I put a couple or three overheads together to try to bring our thinking back into line with our study so that we can get back into it without too much trouble. James chapter 3 is dealing with the problem of man's commitment to status lust, which is called in 1 John the boastful pride of life, but it has to do with this deep-seated drive to be recognized and to be somebody because of what we can do. And this, of course, is the essence of the angelic rebellion when Satan decided that he would exalt himself above God. It was a status lust issue, and it's a fundamental driver when we consider man's makeup, body, soul, and spirit. This is a spiritual element of man, because the spirit is that which motivates the body in its actions, and that produces this desire for recognition as a consequence of the things that it's able to produce through that body. But that status lust, when it's in the unbelieving realm, and what I mean by that is God created us with a desire to be somebody and to do something significant, but he expected us to find our status in his love for us, and then to find the significance of our activity and our walk with and service to him. But men rejecting his love and therefore their status in his eyes, therefore then also reject the service that he would have us render. And when it's in that unbelieving mode, it's fundamentally opposed by God. That was the message of the book of Daniel. God resists the proud. But it's fundamentally opposed by God, because God sees this as the epitome of evil. It's the root problem. The lust of the flesh and the lust of the eyes are problems, but they're not nearly as significant as the pride of life. And God's final and ultimate response to this status lust is the lake of fire as his final answer, which in a very real sense is a pronouncement of the total failure of the spirit of man to achieve any status by what it's done, because when God casts someone into the lake of fire, he's saying, in effect, you're worthless. There's no use for you. I have nothing that you're worth. And it's a pronouncement of worthlessness to those who are therein, which are those who have pursued this. Now, this whole issue of God holding man accountable for his ungodly motivation causes man's reaction, and man's reaction has to do primarily with the antagonism of his heart toward a God who would oppose his objectives, and the reaction to God's opposition is a flaming tongue, according to verse 5 and 6 of James, and that tongue is then used to ignite an antagonism to God in all the realms of man's endeavor, so that he, in everything that he does, becomes anti-theistic. He's antagonistic toward God and so on. James's terminology was a little bit more difficult, because he couched all of this truth in a very succinct statement in which he said the tongue is a fire, the very world of iniquity. That iniquity word is the one that's associated with status lust throughout all the context that's used in the New Testament. And use of the word world, as the tongue is the world of iniquity, that's cosmos, and it has to do with some kind of an organizational or basic fundamental mechanism for accomplishing this thing. So that the tongue is presented by James as the fundamental instrument of man's pursuit of self-exaltation, and that's his speech, the things that he says. But it's set among our members as that which defiles the entire body and sets on fire, literally, the wheel of the generation, translated the course of our life or something, depending on which translation you have. But it's the wheel of the generation, and that in turn is set on fire by Gehenna. So this is Gehenna, and the conceptual realities that are behind the substance of Gehenna, because Gehenna is a literal place of fiery torment. It's a real place. And the fire of Gehenna is designed because man is a physical being. The weeping that is going to be done in Gehenna is because man is a being of soul. And the gnashing of teeth is an element of Gehenna because man is a spiritual being, and it's going to be a strong antagonistic hatred that's going on there causing the gnashing of teeth. This is a very real substantive entity, but there are some conceptual realities behind it, and those conceptual realities are God's uncompromising justice aimed at man's status lust. This is where men go who are fixated on status lust outside of the gospel, and that's based on God's uncompromising justice. I'm sure you've thought about it before, but God can be some things and must be others. What I mean by that is God can be gracious, but he must be just. The scriptures argue that Jesus died on Calvary to demonstrate how God can both be just and the justifier of him that believes on Jesus. So that there is this uncompromising commitment to justice that is never compromised. If it could have been compromised, Jesus died in vain. It's never compromised. And in that uncompromising commitment to justice, which is fundamentally a commitment to life, because justice is necessary in order for life to occur between persons, relational interaction called life requires justice between the persons. And anybody that's committed to status lust is also committed to destroying others in order to exalt himself. That's why it's so bad. So God has this uncompromising commitment aimed at this, and the people know that Gehenna stands for this. And that results in man's burning antagonism and consuming behavior, and that turns into a flame that burns the wheel of the generation. Now, the wheel of the generation is a really highly debated concept. If you study the commentaries on James, you'll probably find all kinds of possible explanations. But the term the generation in the Bible, Jesus warned, for example, the religious leaders that they were of a corrupt and perverse generation. And he warned the people that he preached to that they should flee from the wrath of God and get out of this perverse generation. The whole issue of generation is man and his rebellion against God. And man, in his production of children, continues the wheel, the cycle of this antagonism toward God that's fundamentally based at a rejection or antagonism toward God's uncompromising justice. Man comes in the world screaming, I want to do what I want to do, and I don't want anybody holding me accountable for that. And God stands there saying, you're going to be accountable. And it just, you know, men just don't want to hear that. They want to talk all kinds of religious talk, but they really don't want the reality of God's uncompromising justice in the mix. So that's what James has been driving at when he talks about the tongue as a flame, an igniter. But you have to keep it in your mind clearly that James is talking at the metaphor level, because he is blaming all this on the tongue, and it is not the tongue that is the problem. So that's basically where we've been in the weeks past. I'll bring you up to speed. This evening we're going to move into verses 7 and 8 and pursue this issue one more step. James declares in verse 7 and 8 that it is impossible for a human being of himself to control his tongue, given the assumption of the chapter, and that is that he's a status seeker, given man's commitment to elevating himself in the eyes of others, it is impossible for him to control his tongue. And we're going to look at that. However, I want to begin this study by backing up to chapter 1 and verse 26 and 7, because it's clear from chapter 1, verses 26 and 27, that James obviously believes that the tongue can be dominated by a certain kind of man. It says in verse 26, if anyone thinks himself or seems to be, depending on the translation of that dokeo there, if anyone thinks himself or appears to be religious and doesn't bridle his tongue but deceives his own heart, this man's religion's worthless. And so it's pretty clear that the text, as a precursor to chapter 3, establishes certain things fairly clearly. The first thing that it establishes in verse 26 is that one of the primary purposes of religion, quote-unquote, however James is using it, is religion. One of the primary purposes of religion is to enable a man to bridle his tongue. That's what the verse is saying. Because if a man seems to be or thinks himself to be religious and does not accomplish this, that he bridles his tongue, his religion's worthless, which is rather remarkable when you stop and think about it. I mean, you could say that religion's purpose is this or that or that or that and come up with all kinds of highfalutin objectives and goals, but James's statement is it fundamentally exists to enable man to bridle his tongue, and if it doesn't do that, doesn't matter what else it enables him to do or not to do, his religion's worthless. That's kind of amazing. However, in our political mess this week, we are seeing as clear-cut an example of how disastrous the tongue is when it is used by a person who is given over to status-seeking. In a very real sense, there's nothing he can do about his tongue because he's not able to control it. And even though he attempts to use religion, it's worthless because it doesn't enable him to speak the truth. So it's pretty clear from James 1:26 that a fundamental objective of religion is to enable a man to control his mouth, his tongue. Now, he also says in verse 27 that pure and undefiled religion in the sight of our God and Father is to visit orphans and widows in their distress and to keep oneself unstained or unspotted by the world. Now, that unspotted by the world, that term unspotted, is the same word with the alpha prefix, which is the un, that's used over here in James chapter 3, verse 6, when it talks about that which defiles the entire body. That word translated defiles in the NASB is the word spotted. It's the same word as in chapter 1, verse 27. So there's a direct connection here that the tongue is what spots us, and pure religion, according to verse 27, is that we keep ourselves unspotted by the world, by the cosmos. And he called the tongue the world of the iniquity. So there's a direct link between chapter 1, verse 26, and chapter 3, verses 6 and 7. It's deliberate because James is claiming in chapter 1 that religion's primary purpose is to enable a person to bridle his tongue, to keep him from spotting himself, defiling himself. Now, that's at the level of the metaphor, the tongue. The tongue, however, is simply a primary instrument of the heart. Jesus, for example, in Luke 6:45, taught very clearly that out of the abundance of the heart, the mouth speaks. So that the real problem with the speech that comes out of the mouth, the real problem of the tongue is not the tongue at all, it's the heart. Because it is out of the abundance of the heart that the mouth speaks. So if you really want to control the tongue, guess where you got to go? To the heart. It doesn't do any good at all to focus on the tongue. That's why the psalmist even had to pray that God would put a guard on his lips. Because unless God gets involved in this process at the heart level, the tongue's just going to keep on rattling. And the things that it says will be inevitably geared toward self-exaltation and the destruction of others. So, since Jesus taught that in Luke 6, one of the puzzles is Matthew 15. Because in Matthew 15, Jesus acknowledged that this people is near me, they draw near me with their lips, but their heart's far from me, which seems to be kind of a contradiction of what he said in Luke 6. If the tongue speaks out of the abundance of the heart, how can the tongue be near or the lips draw near to God when the heart's far from him? Well, only by one method, and that is hypocritical deception. And Jesus frankly admitted that men can use their tongues in hypocritical deception. James acknowledges that in chapter 1, verse 26 and 27. That a person can put on an appearance and even deceive himself into believing that he's religious, that is, everything that God wants him to be, without ever affecting his speech. So apparently there was some kind of hypocrisy and deception going on, and Jesus acknowledged that it even reaches to the lips. In fact, one of the most graphic declarations in the scriptures is Paul's in chapter 3 of Romans. I'd like for you to turn over there, because verse 13 is one of the most graphic descriptions of the depravity of man that you'll find anywhere outside of Psalm 5 and 140, where this is quoted from. But I want you to notice what it says in Romans 3, verse 13. Their throat is an open grave. With their tongues they keep deceiving. The poison of asps is under their lips. I want you to visualize this. The throat is an open grave. Now, the trick is to get the person to fall into the grave. So, the deceiver is the tongue. It's the bait. And the things that it says attracts the person to enter into the mouth. But there's poison under the lips. So if the person is ever suckered into getting close enough to the tongue, where the poison of asps can get him, he'll fall right into the grave. Isn't that as graphic a picture? I mean, we see pictures of fish that are kind of like that. In fact, I've seen an illustration of marine life where there's an actual fish that dangles I don't know if it's a fish or its victim, but there's some marine creature that dangles kind of a bait-like thing, and it suckers its victim in. And well, Romans 3 says that man is that way. He seeks the death of others, and he uses his tongue in deception to draw them close enough so that the poison can get them. And it's interesting that that's exactly the terminology of verses 7 and 8 of James 3. The tongue is a restless evil full of deadly poison. So, Jesus acknowledges that the mouth or the tongue can be a deceptive thing, but in the final analysis, Jesus' statement, out of the abundance of the heart the mouth speaks, is that given a little time, the preponderance of the weight of what's in the heart will finally show itself. You can put on a charade for a while. I mean, you can use your tongue deceptively for a while, but because of what's in the heart, eventually what's in the heart will overrule all the charade and reveal itself in the speech of the tongue. And of course, you see illustrations of that a lot, where a person goes to church, sings the hymns, and on Monday morning he's cursing like a trooper out there, and you got to ask yourself, wait a minute. Just yesterday he was singing about how I love Jesus, and now he's using his name in vain. What's going on here? Well, the abundance of the heart is what's going on here. It's showing up. So when James says in chapter 3 that the tongue is a problem, he is saying it within the context of the theology that the problem is really in the heart. And the tongue is simply the expressor of what's in there. Now, the primary value of the heart, according to verse 6, the very world of iniquity, is the heart is set on achieving status in the eyes of others. That is one of the primary values of the heart. Given that, the tongue is uncontrollable because it will start saying things to self-exalt and other destruct. Because one of the best ways to lift yourself up is tear others down. So it's a common and wicked process. But according to James chapter 1, James's assumption is there is a way for the tongue to be dominated. However, in chapter 3, he seems to completely deny that. He says in verse 7, every species of beast and birds, of reptiles and creatures of the sea, is tamed and has been tamed by the human race, but no one can tame the tongue. Now, what he's driving at there is that James, in verse 7, is claiming a certain and fairly extensive level of ability on man's part. Now, that's critical to this issue of the whole concept of status lust, because one of the basic issues is I want to be recognized because of what I can do. And therefore, assigning the ability to do something fairly powerful plays right into this whole thesis. And what James is saying in verse 7 is that every kind of wild animal, bird, reptile, and marine life has already been tamed by the time he writes this by the human race. That's amazing. That's an amazing claim. We see evidences of it today in our trained whales and the circus tricks of all these different kinds of animals that are able to be trained to do things. We see evidences of this, but James is clearly saying that men have consistently been able to do this. Why? Well, it's as old as Genesis 2. When God created man, he created him to rule. And when he created the animals, he created them to be ruled by man. And when he brought the created animals to the created man, he brought them so that Adam could name them. And in Hebrew terminology, man has dominion over whatever he can name. He is the head over whatever he can name. So God called man Adam, but man, Adam, called all of the animals by whatever name he assigned to them. God brought them to see what Adam would call them. But it was an exercise of lordly dominion that God had created Adam to exercise. He created him to rule. When he said, "Let us make man in our image after our likeness and let him rule," that "and let him rule" means that that's the express image. That's the activity of the image. Man is in the likeness and image of God when he is exercising dominion. Now, there's two ways to approach that, of course. Godly dominion is servant leadership. Ungodly dominion is tyrannical demandingness. But nonetheless, man is most like God when he's exercising dominion. And so James is simply claiming that man has a fairly significant level of capability. But when he gets to verse 8, he takes that capability completely away. He claims that the tongue is more powerful than the man. That's kind of an interesting declaration. No man can tame the tongue. It's a restless evil full of deadly poison. I want us to think about that. There's a great deal of loose talk in our generation and in generations past about man being a creature of free will. What does that mean? Well, it depends on who you're talking to. But typically, free will implies that man has the capacity to make decisions and pursue them and accomplish the objectives. He can make the decisions. That's what free will implies. But James is plainly saying here that there is something outside of the realm of man's volitional capacity, and that's the control of his tongue. His will isn't nearly as free as he thought it was. Now, how does that work? Well, let's think about it in this light. The choices of man are not the primary issue. Why do men make choices? Why do we choose to do anything? Yeah, there's an objective that we want to accomplish. What governs the choice we make in relation to that objective we want to accomplish? If I want to change the tire on my Suburban because I got a nail in it in San Antonio yesterday and the air's leaking out, I have an objective. I want to change the tire on my truck. Let's suppose that of the options that I have to accomplish that, one of them is to tell Hazel to do it. One of them is to get the jack out of the truck and jack it up and use the tools that are necessary to take it off. One of them is to come to my office and work on the computer. And another one is to go to the store or whatever in another car and do some shopping or whatever. But now some of those options are obviously not going to work. So I make my choices based on what I believe will accomplish the objective. Now, there are only a couple of those that I believe will work. And one's not nearly as possible as the other one, or probable, let me say it that way. To treat Hazel fairly here, let me just say that she'd do if I told her to. But I'm not going to tell her to. My point is simply, choices are at least three steps down from the critical issues. The critical issue is what you want to do. That's your objective. The Bible calls that agape. That's your love. The next step from what you want to do is the decision on how you're going to accomplish it. And that has to do with your mental processes and what you believe will work. So that you have love and faith before you ever get to the choice. So that by the time you get to the will element, the choice element, you're no longer free. Because you're being driven by your objective and what you believe about how to accomplish that. You see what I'm saying? Your will is actually in bondage to two things: what you love and what you believe. And it's really not free to move out of the perimeters of those things, because you cannot make yourself choose to do things that you do not believe will work, or to pursue things that you have no interest in. I use this illustration with my young people up in Nebraska. If you believe your will is really all that dominating, make yourself believe that the moon is made out of green or blue cheese. You say, well, that'd be ridiculous. Everybody knows it's not made. Make yourself believe it is. Well, why would anybody want to make themselves believe something that's not true? Well, you see where faith is dominating your choices there? If you don't believe it's true, then you can't make yourself believe it. And if you believe it's true, you don't have to be made to believe it. It's not even a matter of choice. So when James says that you can't control your tongue, he is driving us backwards from our pride of ability to do. And actually, he says, no one can. The word he uses there is the final word for power. There are basically three words for power in the scriptures. This is the strongest one. No one has the ability in any sense to tame the tongue when it comes to the human race. Man as a generation, the wheel of generation, as a human being, unaided by God, he has no ability. Why not? Because he cannot dominate his heart. If we could make ourselves love the things that ought to be loved and make ourselves hate what ought to be despised, we would be in heaven. Life would be a piece of cake. Because if we could make ourselves love what we ought to love and hate what we ought to hate, then everything else would just kind of, we'd have one problem, and that would be, what should we believe about these things that we rightly love and rightly hate? And that problem would be resolved by the revelation that God has given us, the scriptures. So if we used our minds to inform them about the things that will and won't work to achieve these things that we love because we should and hate because we should, then life would be a piece of cake. The problem is, we cannot write on our own hearts what ought to be there. And that's why we can't control our tongues. Nobody can control his tongue. He is really relentless in verse 8 in telling us that it's a restless evil and full of deadly poison, because what he's really saying is the heart is full of deadly poison. Now, how do you put these two chapters together, chapter 1 and chapter 3, where in chapter 1 he says if man doesn't bridle his tongue, his religion's worthless, and in chapter 3 he says he can't control his tongue? Well, obviously, the only way you can put those together is to recognize that James understood that there is a way to control it, but it is not in man to do it. That in this religion thing, there has to be a way in which man can have his innermost being, his heart and his mind, altered by his God so that it results in the bridling of his tongue. Because the God that he worships is changing the values of his heart and changing the concepts that he believes in his mind, so that the first element of the new covenant is a new heart. And one of the primary commands of the under the new covenant is that you be transformed by the renewing of your mind. So that if God gives you a new heart and your mind is transformed, then your tongue will follow automatically. But it's not you controlling it. It's him. As he inscribes on the heart what ought to be there. So James obviously believed, according to chapter 1, that religion would produce the dominion over the tongue. But he also obviously believed that in chapter 3, if men were going to use the church as a way to exalt themselves, to try to become teachers and seek status through the if men were going to try to use religion to exalt themselves rather than to bridle their tongue, then they would be completely incapable of controlling their tongue whatsoever, because their motives are wrong. And if you're not motivated properly, your will is not able to break free, because it's driven by the motives and the methods. So love and faith are the critical issues, and the choice is, you know, the third thing down. It's not an unnecessary thing, but it is the third thing. And since proper love is something that only God can produce, love is fruit of the Spirit of God. It's not the natural condition of man's heart. In fact, John says, everyone who loves is born of God. The corollary to that is, no one who's not born of God can love. So all the love talk that the world does is deception. The world cannot love. Since that's true, then obviously love is in the dominion of God and his activity on our behalf. And then, of course, the engrafted word that he talked about in chapter 1, if we submit ourselves to it, it becomes the mind-changing factor that informs our faith, so that by love and proper faith, the tongue is therefore controlled. Otherwise, it's a restless and deadly, poisonous evil. So, what James is actually driving at all the way through this chapter is the wickedness of seeking status in unbelief. Because the whole point of chapter 3 is seeking to be free from the temptation to seek status in the eyes of men, and ignore the love of God that gives us our true status. Status is simply your position of value in the eyes of somebody, and if God loves you, then you have it, and if he doesn't, you don't. So that's what verses 7 and 8 seem to be driving at, that man has a tremendous amount of ability, verse 7, but when it comes to the critical issue that religion's primarily designed to accomplish, he doesn't even have the beginning of an ability. His heart is full of restless evil and in deadly poison. Okay, any questions or comments?
Humble seems as though you can just listen to what a person says and know the condition of his heart.
Well, if you listen long enough, that's true. The problem, of course, is that in the doctrine of the new heart, there is a apparently, in the regeneration process, God gives us a new heart, but he doesn't get rid of the old one. So we end up having two different motivating bases. One is the old heart of stone, and the other is the new heart of flesh that he's promised that comes with the covenant. And until the body of flesh is done away, until the resurrection of the body, the old heart's not done away. So one of the problems with deciding what a person is truly is you don't know which one's really being the hypocritical one. You don't know if when he's talking like you would expect him to, if he's revealing the true self, or if when he's talking like he ought not to be, he's revealing the true self. You can't tell. And Paul recognized with Timothy, for example, that that's a major issue, and he says, nevertheless, the foundation of God stands sure. God knows them that are his. But let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity. So, you know, we really can't make the final determination on almost anybody. Floyd?
It's almost saying that there's a week third of the
harvest.
Yeah, all the thing is that you don't even know there's tares and wheat and oats, not only among the people, but also in among the each person.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's the reason why in the final analysis the issue of our salvation cannot be up to human performance or doing, because there aren't any of us that perform anywhere close to good enough. Jesus was the only one who could. And so those of us who believe that Jesus did enough and was perfect in all his doings and that it's applicable to us, by believing that declared truth, we are then given a new heart, but then it's a process of God writing on our hearts through our lifetime. And I believe that he does it through the experiences that he takes us to in conjunction with the things he teaches us out of his word, so that we have the word and history working together to rewrite the heart. But it's a process, and it ain't over till it's over. I've often wondered why God allows some things to happen that seem so pointless. But I also have recognized that there are some things that I think have been pointless until after the fact. And then I've been able to look back and see, you know, that really wasn't pointless, because it's molded me in a direction now that wouldn't have if it hadn't been done or hadn't happened. Okay, let's have a word of prayer and we'll be dismissed.